All right, I'll call this meeting to order. If I could get a roll call to determine whether we have quorum.
Jensen?
Here.
Lee?
Here.
Youngkin?
Here.
Menz absent. Clark?
Here.
Guthrie?
Here.
Johnston?
Here.
All right, so we have quorum. Looking for a motion to approve the agenda as published.
Motion.
So moved.
I second.
All in favor? Aye.
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 All opposed? All right, great. We'll proceed with the agenda as published. Next, I'm looking for approval of the last meeting's minutes. Did anybody have any edits or anything that they were concerned about with those? Hearing no amendments that want to be made, looking for a motion for approval.
I move that we approve the minutes of the May 7th minutes.
Second.
Okay, this has been moved and seconded on. All in favor of approving the minutes as published, say aye.
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 All opposed? Great. The minutes are approved. Next is the time for public comment for things that are not on our agenda. We have no members of the public in the room. Is there anybody online that's from the public? Okay. So since that don't have any members of the public, we'll move on. We don't have any old business on our agenda. So moving on to new business, we have consideration recommendation on the FY26 Planning and Development Work Program. Go ahead and take it away, Leanne.
Thank you. On the screen, I've shared the draft work program for fiscal year 2026. Since you saw this in May, we've recategorized it under those three headings, the cornerstone to capstone and long-range planning, outreach, and regulations and policies. Also, we did remove the what was already done or anticipated to be done this fiscal year. Did rename the debris site was removed because that was done this year, but we also did add the rural residential development inventory and increase the building code feasibility study to high. Are there any questions of staff? So pending tonight's recommendation, we'll schedule it for Board of Supervisors for next week.
All right. Any discussion from the commission? I guess what are you needing from the commission as far as that goes? Just
a motion and a second. Okay. All right. Regular agenda item.
Yep. Good. So if there's no discussion on this, looking for a motion to approve these changes to the work program as written.
I so move.
One second.
Is a roll call vote necessary or okay? Voice vote or no. Okay. All right. All in favor of approving this as written? Aye.
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 All opposed? Great. All right. And now we're on to our floodplain management learning moment, I believe.
We are. I do have a substantial amount of slides to share with you about floodplain management in Story County. Last year, we talked about bringing some learning moments to the Planning and Zoning Commission and Board of Adjustment. So earlier this year, we did our strategic plan. Since you had a pretty light agenda, I thought it was appropriate that we come forward with floodplain management too. This is something you really, from a regulatory standpoint, you do not deal with the chapter as a recommending body. But as I go further in the presentation, you will see and become aware of where you deal with the regulations. So So the presentation overview, really just talking about purpose of floodplain management regulations, some history lessons and overview of the National Flood Insurance Program, kind of what's happening in Iowa from a floodplain management perspective, look at the our Story County applicable regulations. When I say our, they apply only to unincorporated Story County, and then we have some time for questions. As always, though, if you have questions as we go through, just please stop right there, and probably better to talk about at that point than waiting till the end. As in any planning or almost any area, we do have a series of acronyms. I will be sharing this presentation with you and these acronyms, but it is a science-based field, and so as such, we have a lot of acronyms that we need to learn as part of floodplain management. I'll test you on those later on from looking at that screen fast. But why is flooding an issue? Well, we have human development and interference that affects the flow and movement of waters through our lakes and streams and rivers. Problems arise when people build in the path of the natural flooding process. And to prevent or minimize new problems from occurring, we regulate what is built in the floodplain. Building in the floodplain exposes people to safety and health hazards. Even slow-moving waters can be life-threatening. Flood waters destroy food and medicine. Flooding can shut down water and wastewater treatment facilities, and flooding impacts people's natural or mental health. You can see on this image here on the screen, the top, the channel is the same in both the top and bottom. This is a natural state before any development on the right-hand side of the river or stream has occurred. The house is there, kind of idling along, going at its own little thing. All of a sudden, come in down in the south here, and they start regrading a little bit. You know, image doesn't do it justice, but they add substantial amount of fill here, raise a little bit here, and all of a sudden, you follow the wave over here. This house that was just nice and quiet is getting inundated, and sometimes by the smallest amount of flooding. The water that's displaced from this fill has to go somewhere, and it's naturally going to just follow the path of least resistance, and that will be the house to the left. So flooding is a natural process. We've all seen this from time and time in different iterations in science class throughout our lives. It is a natural phenomenon. We call this the hydrological cycle. I'm not going to go through it because we all know it, but it is something that is happens day in and day out, and there's nothing we can do to prevent this hydrologic cycle. Flooding only becomes a problem when people put development and people in the path of that water that's coming downstream. Floodplain lands and adjacent waters combine to form a complex, dynamic, physical, and biological system found nowhere else. When portions of floodplains are preserved or restored to their natural state, they provide many benefits to both human and natural systems. Floods can bring health hazards in the forms of animal carcasses and garbage. And if you don't believe me, I have actual pictures that I have experienced that and seen that firsthand. Most items that come in contact with floodwaters must be thrown out. Those people that stand in floodwaters should have shots. They should watch for long-lasting health implications. The picture on the top, as you see, shows one of the health hazards that can occur from flooding. That's mold, mildew, and bacteria that grow in damp, flooded areas, sometimes behind walls where we can't even see it. Buildings can be damaged by flooding in so many different ways. The obvious damage is obviously from that soaking in sediment, but again, the longer it stays in there, it wicks up vertically into drywall, insulation, and particle board. Simply letting that house dry out and thinking it will be better back to how it was before is a fallacy. It will not be a healthy place anymore as it was before the flood. We also see the damage that occurs to our buildings and our infrastructure. It's really difficult to see on this image. I should have change of transparency, but this is actually a concrete floor that has buckled due to the buoyancy factors associated with elevated groundwater table caused by the flooding. So in essence, in that basement or lowest level of that house, that flood water is coming up through there and buckling the floor. Then we all know the image on the left, the flood waters that will cover our roads, cover our bridges. We don't know the structural integrity anymore of that bridge, even though the waters are underneath of the piers, the pilings, everything is going to be facing the velocities and the damage from the flood waters. Hydrostatic pressure and hydrodynamic forces damage a building's walls in three ways. You can see in this image the frontal impact of the water coming right from the water source. That's going to be bringing debris. It's going to be bringing a level of velocity and a force against this that may shift out the foundation. Then we have a drag effect on both sides, moving it off that foundation as it goes, going with the current of the water as it's coming down this directional flow. And then on the backside, you have a suction of sorts with a negative pressure on the downstream side. That speed of moving water, as I've called a couple times, is a velocity, and that usually is measured in feet per second. The faster water moves, the more pressure it puts on the structure, and the more it will erode stream banks and scour the earth around a building's foundation. Debris also increases the hazard posed by moving water. Floodwaters can and will pick up anything in its path. That will float. Logs, even things that won't float. Logs, lumber, ice, propane, and farm chemical tanks, and vehicles. Turn around, don't drown is something we all need to follow. Moving water will drag or roll objects that don't float. All the debris then can act as battering rams that knock holes in walls and demolish foundations. So back to this image I showed a couple of slides ago. This is what many refer to as a hydrological cycle. So starts down here in the flooding. Okay, we're seeing the flooding from 2008. We're seeing the houses built burst through off their foundation. Okay, people are dealing with this. Flood insurance policies don't exist. We start the recovery phase. We're reconstructing. We're either doing buyouts, we're building again, we're elevating, we're putting whatever in there to make this a more secure location. We're just not heeding the advice, and we're building right where we were again the same way. Okay, but it's 3 years later. We're still good. That 100-year flood that happened 2 years ago is not going to happen for another 99 years. We're good, or 97, whatever the math is. We come into this day of flood and amnesia. We've forgotten all this stuff. We've forgotten all this stress. We get to some rain coming. We get some more rain coming, some snow melt, more rain. All of a sudden, oh my gosh, we're going to flood again. We're looking at stream gauges or right back here again. Experience shows that immediately after a flood, that concern rises, but then within a year or so, that concern is just absent 100%. So the history lesson for tonight is up until 1968, which is when the National Flood Insurance Program was established by an act of the United States Congress, federal actions related to flooding were really only in response to significant events. And those responses were more structural measures to control flooding. Straightening of streams. If you look at an aerial photograph of Skunk River south of City of Ames between Ames and Cambridge, you see how it's very straightened. And you can also see, though, how... You can see how it's starting to meander, going back to how it was. But that was a solution. Let's straighten it. Let's get through faster. Increase the velocities, go down the river. The passage of the Flood Control Act of 1936 was one of those measures. You know, we look at that straightening. That's when a lot of those activities through CCC started occurring. A lot of the projects in especially the East Coast were undertaken at that point. Then starting in the 1950s, we started talking about the feasibility of providing flood insurance. It became clear that private insurance companies could not profitably provide coverage at an affordable price because primarily of the catastrophic nature of flooding and inability to develop an actual rate structure. And I do want to just point out that flooding does not just mean water. Mudslides are a part of flooding. So it's a greater impact than just the water coming down the stream. Finally, we get to 1956, where the Federal Insurance Act is talked about, but actually never actually implemented. Starting in the 1960s, then, we started passing the Southeast Hurricane Disaster Relief Act. And then we get to 1968, finally, where we had several feasibility studies done. The National Flood Insurance Program was adopted to do three things: better indemnify individuals for flood losses through insurance, reduce future flood damages through state and community floodplain management regulations, and reduce federal expenditures for disaster assistance and flood control. We did not, Story County, though, adopt the maps in 1968. Majority of jurisdictions did not because the mapping was not there. The mapping was across the country evolved. We got to the 1980s is when we first adopted our floodplain maps. Then going on to what the National Flood Insurance Program means, it means there's a level of federal control. The National Program Oversight, National Flood Insurance Program is run through FEMA. They help with the mapping, they do all the mapping nationwide of our special flood hazard areas. They have some standards that are the minimum standards that all jurisdictions must meet, stressing minimum because I'll revisit that in a little bit. And then they also run the insurance end of it. States then have their own program oversight. They establish additional standards. They provide technical assistance to the communities. And in this case, Story County is a community. And then they evaluate and make sure we're doing the things we need to be doing as a local community. But then it gets down to a local role, where really that's kind of where the rubber meets the road. And development oversight is strictly a local responsibility, with a couple exceptions I will note. But what we do, we are required to adopt and enforce floodplain management ordinance compliant with both federal and state laws. We issue or deny development, we inspect, and then we make substantial damage determinations. So with that, we have five responsibilities I kind of touched on right there. But what these do is they help ensure we're building and recovering safer, stronger, and smarter. If we know an area is mapped as having potential to flood, and we know people could be in danger and buildings could be damaged, it makes sense. And we have the responsibility, dating back to 1968, to take reasonable protective steps as communities to develop and then redevelop as appropriate. Where you just saw the five responsibilities of communities, National Flood Insurance Program has issued five basic rules we must follow. I will read these for you. Rule number one, we must use the latest maps and flood data published by FEMA. This can be a catch-22 because you heard me say flood data published by FEMA. In certain circumstances, like we do have right now, the Iowa DNR has better maps, more accurate maps, but when it comes from a strictly floodplain management perspective, we are bound by those FEMA maps. Until they are adopted by FEMA, we cannot use them. We can kind of refer to them, but regulatory standpoint, we cannot. A permit is required for all development, and if we don't do that, we get caught. Then we could face some punishment, which I'll talk about here in a second. Development must not increase flood hazard on other properties. New buildings must be protected from damage from the base flood, and I'll talk about the base flood and what that means. And then last, our substantial improvement damage rule, that if the cost of improvements or cost of repair exceeds 50% of the market value, it must be brought to current floodplain management standards. This recognizes that we have many pre-firm buildings, so before 1968, 1983, that were built maybe in lower areas that are likely to be damaged, but if they get damaged, we want them brought into conformance. So what happens if we don't listen to those five rules, and if we don't do everything that's expected of us as a community? The NFIP takes seriously community commitments and responsibilities to enforce floodplain management. There's two levels of enforcement. There's the probation, and with that, unfortunately, the punishment does not go to Story County. It goes to the residents within the county that have flood insurance. There is an increase to their flood insurance policies. Now, Story County may have flood insurance, so we may feel that as well, but the direct impact is to majority of our property owners that have flood insurance. If we get through probation and we're not okay, we can be suspended. And what that means, unfortunately, is that we are not participating in the National Flood Insurance Program. If we are not participating in the National Flood Insurance Program, property owners cannot get flood insurance through them. They have to go to the private market. And what that can be is very costly and sometimes prohibitive of acquiring property. If you have a federally backed mortgage, you have to have flood insurance. So that is the catch-22 and why we are encouraged to really do the best we can do with our floodplain management program. So we have a three-tiered approach, and this is really put on us by the federal level to the state to the local, and then we build on that too. We do floodplain management, the regulatory aspect. We rely on the maps, and then we flood insurance. We don't do flood insurance, but that's part of the three-tiered approach. So development, when we get to talking about floodplain, is very broad and is purposefully done. If you look, the Code of Federal Regulations will be worded like this. Any man-made changes to improved or unimproved real estate, including but not limited to buildings or other structures, mining, dredging, filling, grading, paving, excavation, or drilling operations, or storage of equipment or materials. With that, we used to joke years ago that you could take a hole or take a bucket, dig a hole in the floodplain, fill the bucket, and you need a permit. Yeah, if you look at that as strictly as you could, that could be true, but we do have some way to not be that strict. Just some kind of data to throw at you. So really, a lot of people, okay, it's a 100-year flood. It's a 500-year flood. That common way we refer to it, which is not statistically correct, it's just the percentage, what this shows is percentage chance of one or more floods of a given magnitude being equal to or exceeded in a 30-year period, which your typical mortgage is a 30-year mortgage. So if you look at that 100-year flood, if they're in the floodplain, they have a 26% chance of being flooded throughout that 30-year time. That's a big risk. And so that is why we put the regulations in place to try to help reduce the risk on these properties. So just some more acronyms to throw at you. The two important ones for us right now are the first two ones, the flood insurance rate map. This is what the flood insurance vendors or what they use to assign flood insurance rates, but it's also actually the mapping component of it too. The lower right image shows the special flood hazard area. We don't get into actuarial and all that. We're at the locational aspect of these, looking at the map. But then I meant to bring it up. If you ever do want to read our flood insurance study, it's full of lots of history of flooding in Story County, but it has all the plans and profiles of our streams too. But that really is something that is kind of the down and dirty of floodplain management when we have to get those out and look at that. These older two things, a flood hazard boundary map and a flood boundary and floodway map, were our first two products. And then once they got more detailed mapping done, they became the flood insurance rate maps. And so the iteration of how it came to be. So the special flood hazard area is what we call that 100-year flood. Technically, it's the 1% annual chance, and we regulate the 1% annual chance or greater flood. You also call it the base flood. It's where we regulate all of our floodplain management, whether it's the detailed study or non-detailed study. In order to determine the flood hazard area, that's done by FEMA and their contractors. They look at hydrology and hydraulics of a flooding source. They look at flood elevations, velocity, floodplain widths, cross sections, and frequency of the flood flow. Really, as we've gone over the years, the more better our topographic data has become, the more accurate our maps have become. Prior to 2018, our maps were based on 10-foot contours, and our floodplain was very wide in some areas where it was extremely flat and not really in line with any kind of flooding we could happen to. I don't want to say it would never flood, because I don't want to say that, but it did not make sense. The latest iteration of maps is based on a LIDAR, and it's pretty accurate, I think. As accurate as it can be. So the base flood, what is that? Why does FEMA use it for mapping? You see it right here. So here's the normal channel. So this is the area that we can expect in that 1% annual chance flood the waters to go. When it gets out of its banks and it rises, it'll go from this, in a perfect world, this side and this side. This is assuming, FEMA's models assume a certain level of increase in here. I don't want to try to explain their models because I do not understand them because I'm not an engineer. But it does not account for filling entirely in this floodway. The floodway is where you want to keep everything limited. Minimum amount of fill as possible. So this is another way to look at it from the mapping standpoint. So this is that floodway. This zone AE is another way to say the floodway fringe. They're the same thing, only in different ways, mapping or regulations. Zone A is the entire floodplain. So in this case, FEMA did not go in and do a detailed study to map this floodway boundary and the floodway fringe boundary. Majority of our land is in this zone A, which is problematic sometimes. It does mean we need to work with the DNR a lot to get the information. And then just another way to look at it, this one image goes all the way to the 10% annual chance flood, but this is our 1%, our base flood elevation. This is our 500-year or 2% annual chance flood. So you see how the different elevations and probabilities increase. So a little bit more on that regulatory floodway. Managing floodplain development ensures flooding does not increase or affect upstream property owners. That floodway is an essential floodplain management tool to manage and prevent those increased risks. These areas show the base flood elevations needed to set whatever our minimum protection levels are for new buildings or new structures. And that's where you see the A, the AE, all that on the maps. In many areas, we do have higher mapping standards. I said that earlier, I'd get to Iowa's. The National Floodplain Insurance Program, NFIP, sets minimum standards. Iowa exceeds those minimum standards. Story County exceeds the state's minimum standards. But I do want to note that higher mapping standards do not prevent development. We don't say you cannot develop in the floodplain. You just need to meet these additional expectations. Part of that is a no rise. And that, again, does not mean no development. It just means that development must be careful about its impacts on others. And we need certifications that demonstrate that. This is just an image that shows then what it looks like when you add a freeboard or additional space above that base flood elevation. Here's the base flood elevation right here. This house, you know, really was not built elevated. It's on this side here. This really doesn't look, I mean, the creek probably is over here, but this is all the floodplain. This house was elevated, so they did not get inundated with water. Okay, another look at the special flood hazard area and additional considerations for floodways. Computer models, as I said earlier, I don't begin to understand these, but they do simulate that encroachment that's allowed in this area over here in order to determine this base flood elevation. So there is some modeling that goes on behind the scenes, but what's important is we in Story County do not, we have a development standard for no rise. We don't allow it to any rise whatsoever, and we track that both upstream and downstream of the development location. Any questions thus far? Okay, getting on to what the DNR does and what Story County does. So the DNR has what's called as delegated communities. So again, federal, state, local. State has its own set of floodplain regulations, but what they've said is some counties and cities, jurisdictions are able to do a lot of what the state could do on their own. So they've delegated this authority or this ability to issue permits to these additional jurisdictions. We are one of them. So when we have a detailed study, and so if we have a floodway and floodway fringe delineated, and we have other guidelines we have to meet, we are able to issue our own permits. So for people doing development, there's only us to go through, which is sometimes good, but for us sometimes bad because we like the DNR's involvement too. I will say last time we spoke with the DNR, the idea of delegated communities may be going away, which is maybe a good thing because some jurisdictions have gone rogue and been issuing a lot of permits that should not have been. But what this means, we have to take our own permits in, which this permit on the side is an older one. We do everything online, but we do all of our enforcement. We do everything that the state would do and if we were not involved. So what authority has not been delegated to us? We cannot revise our ordinance without the DNR approving it. So when we take changes forward to Chapter 80, our floodplain management ordinance, we will have it approved by the DNR after we have the board supervisors approve it. If they say there's something wrong, we have to go back again. We also don't have the authority to issue permits on our own for channel alterations, flood control levees. We do have for bridges and dams in certain instances, given the size of the watershed. But we also, more importantly, don't have the authority to grant a variance without the concurrence of the Department of Natural Resources. That is key, and that is probably why we have not granted a variance in Story County for a floodplain management ordinance or floodplain management variance. So our ordinance is, again, Chapter 80, floodplain management. It is legally enforceable that must be approved by both FEMA in order for us to continue to participate in the NFIP, so we can't just change one thing and then expect FEMA to, if FEMA does not agree with it, we have to change it back, essentially. The Iowa legislation or Iowa state law, we are able to have a standalone ordinance, which is why it does not come before you when we make changes to it. Chapters 85, 86, all those are part of the land development regulations. Chapter 80 is not part of that whole grouping, and so it goes right to the Board of Supervisors as a home rule authority and a standalone ordinance. Permitting process overview, just quickly, why review proposed developments to decrease loss of life and property, to increase in the importance of hazard mitigation, restore and protect natural resources and function of floodplains. And by the way, we'll just note, I was up by Leslie and I both were up by Dotson Farms today, the wetland up there. It's working. If you have a chance to drive up there and look at it, it's has a lot of water in it at this point. As the National Flood Insurance Program is taxpayer funded, we review permits and issue them to make sure that disaster costs are reduced, decrease insurance costs, and then increase sustainability and livability. So what activities in the special flood hazard area, the floodplain, require permit? If I was asking a quiz on the left-hand side, I'd want you to say everything does, except for that bucket, filling a bucket of dirt. Even Story County departments need a permit. Conservation, Story Secondary Roads is on our bridges. What we don't require permits for, and we cannot, state and federal projects. We cannot require projects, or like for the U.S. Highway 30 bridge project, we don't get a permit through the state or from other cities that are inside their jurisdictions. We review permits to make sure that they meet all the requirements, that the use is permitted. If everything meets the requirements, we issue a permit, we do inspections, normal procedural matters. If it doesn't, we'll deny it, or we'll work with them to go back to the drawing board. At the counter on the phone when people come in, we do as much as we can, though, and I really celebrate the job we do, move away from the floodplain. Don't go to this level to develop here. We do have a three-foot freeboard requirement in Story County, and I'll show you a slide, the importance of that, but that does increase the cost for construction. So move out, move 10 feet away so you don't have to deal with that. But if they can't get anything and they decide they want to do a variance, we have to follow the regulations. But again, any variance approved by Story County cannot become effective unless it's approved by the DNR. And again, two, I think, in the past 20-some years have even been submitted, none approved. So that three-foot elevation, what difference that makes. So this house right here, this line right here is the base flood elevation. So 1% chance flood, the 100-year flood, whatever you want to call it. This case, this house pays $95,000 over 10 years in flood insurance, $9,500 a year. They're 4 feet below the flood. So they're getting insurance, but they're also getting flooded too, likely. So this house right here, this is right at the base flood elevation, which is what the minimum NFIP standard is. So they're paying $1,400 a year. So it drops down substantially. This is 3 feet. This is us in Story County. Here's a base flood. They've elevated 3 feet. They're paying $427 a year, or over 10 years, $4,270. On a 30-year mortgage, that's substantial. And this is why we eventually, one of many reasons we went to that 3 foot elevation of freeboard. If you do elevate in Story County, you had to elevate on fill. That's the only way we do it. And we do have standards for compaction related to fill. We do also regulate substantial damage, substantial improvement. A lot on this slide, I won't read it to you, but it's important that we know the pre-construction costs and the amount of damage that's been done or amount of improvement that's being done to a property, and whether or not that brings them that they need to come into conformance with our regulations. And then you get involved from a floodplain management standpoint when you're reviewing subdivisions. This is a slide that's from the American Planning Association, a report that they did about developing in the floodplain and impacts from flood hazard areas. And obviously, they have houses right here. The blue is the floodplain. Enjoying the tree right along the river here, the trees, the wooded areas. Chances are they're going to get flooded, probably larger homes back here. This one, here's a 100-year floodplain. This is still a little bit too close for my liking, but they're not located in this floodplain. In this case, they're putting them in a public open space, which is what we saw like at Dotson or Prairie Valley, which is what we do encourage. We do in our subdivisions require those established boundaries be shown. And then actually, when you go to our general site planning standards, we take another approach on managing our floodplains by having the stream buffers mapped and actually kind of providing more protection than in some cases our special flood hazard areas have. Again, our maps are not perfect. So this will be based on ground measurements of survey. So we have surveyors that have to define this buffer, and then this is part of the documentation, the final plat approval. So with that, Story County, a number of years ago, decided to start participating in the community rating system. It's a voluntary program of the National Flood Insurance Program. I think we started in 2014. I was actually appointed as the CRS coordinator. So what this does is for jurisdictions that have higher regulatory practices, have really solid floodplain management programs, if you are accepted into the community rating system, those that get flood insurance in your community realize flood insurance premium reductions. So 5% a point. So all jurisdictions, whether or not they participate or not, are a class 10 community. So no one gets a discount. You go in, you do some minimum things, and I've heard every jurisdiction in Iowa could go in as a class 9 because the state has a 1-foot freeboard requirement. That would be a 5% discount to those that have flood insurance. Story County, I'm proud to say, is a class 7 community. We've maintained that. We cannot actually go above a class 7 community until we adopt a building code. Requirement to have a class 6 is to have a building code. So we actually have enough points to be a class 6 community, but we don't have it for the realization. But what that does say is our property owners do get 15% discount, though, for their flood insurance premiums. And then with that, some resources for you. Following the 2008 flooding, Iowa State Extension, the State of Iowa, Iowa Association of State and Floodplain Managers, IFSMA, and others put together a video series about flooding in Iowa. Okay, I know it's from 2008, 2009, but they're still relevant. They provide a lot of the information I just gave in short snippets. They're geared towards elected officials, volunteer boards, and commission members. So I can share this link with you. It's worthwhile. You can watch, fast forward, go on to the next one. Just know they are a little bit dated. If you ever want to know how to find your base flood elevation or where your floodway is, you can, several tools. You can use the Iowa DNR's permit system. PRMT, it's a link on our website, but this is what we encourage people to go through to see if they need a DNR permit too. And then we have a very robust amount of resources on our website. You'll see these boxes on the right hand side. That's a snippet from our website. Y'all know where that is, but you can look at the Iowa Flood Information System. That's hosted in Iowa City at the Iowa Flood Center. They have live up-to-date mapping. FEMA's FloodSmart, where they have post-flooding resources, you name it. Then the Map Service Center has all the at the same location. No, that's different. I'll have to fix that link. They have the maps, too. Then you can also see the maps on our website, the Beacon website. We don't have the level of detail, though. We just have the static maps. But you can turn the floodplain layer on and off. If it's a light blue, it's a detailed study. So there's a floodway and floodway fringe. If it's dark blue, no detailed study. And then lastly, the National Flood Hazard Layer. This is a product from FEMA, and this gives you about anything you want. I use this a lot in day-to-day use on floodplain management. With that, that is your 30,000 foot overview, and believe me, that is a 30,000 foot overview. As much detail I gave you, that's not even anywhere near what we deal with. What questions do you have for me?
I'm just curious. Thank you, Leanne. This is very, very good. How many structures are we talking about when we're talking about development in Story County, that not counting cities, of course, like everything that's happening in Ames, but for Story County, what are you looking at as far as structures in floodplains that are at risk?
So I'm going to answer this a couple of ways. One, if you ask anyone in the planning and development staff, we cannot tell you the number of individuals that have flood insurance policies, because that is confidential information through FEMA. We've all signed the paperwork that will go to jail if we tell you.
Right.
But given that, well, I will say, given the acreage of the amount of properties we have in unincorporated Story County that have floodplain on it, the percentage is very low of properties that have flood insurance, which is disheartening to me. But again, a lot of those already have mortgages paid off, or they just don't have mortgage and they did not need it. The number of structures, actually, I think I'm trying to remember what the last report was to on our community rating system. I think we're sub 100. We don't have a lot of structures.
Yeah.
And structures include even grain bins and everything. We went through and we hand counted them. I will get you guys that number, because it fluctuated from our last report to this, and we could have gone up because more accurate aerial imagery, or we could have gone down. I don't remember. I should know that. But it's not what you would assume. It's not as high as you would assume. And what I will say too is we do a very good job of, when people come in, we really encourage them to move away from the floodplain. And the development we do see in the floodplain is necessary to locate there, because, like, if you look at a Grand and sand and gravel extraction site, they need a scale house. Sand and gravel is going to be in a lower area where floodplain exists. So we will permit a scale house. We permit mostly stream bank stabilization, fill dirt related to that.
Okay. Yeah, I wonder even if the flood of 1993 took care of a number of structures there.
Yeah, after the flood in 93, we had a buyout of I think there's 7 buyout properties after the floods of 93.
Okay.
And then just some properties just did cease to exist, but majority of the impacts were related to structures inside city limits of Ames and Nevada.
Yeah. This is not so related, but, and I know there's no there's no ordinance for this kind of work, but I know you have someone on staff for the county as far as water quality, and looking at encouraging farmers to farm in a way that would actually help prevent flooding as far as downstream. I'm just wondering if there's any work on that in the county.
That, well, that we're fortunate that Sarah Carmichael is our watershed management coordinator for Story County, and she is our Marcus, what do you call her? Our honorary planning and development member, because she resides in our office. Her office is right in between Marcus and my offices. So as she's seeing properties that are putting bioreactors in or whatever, she's knowing that they will need a floodplain permit or not need a floodplain permit, or we're having dialogues with her too.
Okay. Thank you.
It's been really nice to see out in Iowa Creek that they've been scooping out sections so that if there's extra water, they go in those pools. So then it doesn't affect downstream into maybe Hilton might not have another flooding incident. We hope not. But it's really great to see how DNR is coming up and doing some mitigation and renovation maybe of the Iowa Creek. At least that's what I see.
Are you talking inside city limits?
No, I'm talking out by us. I'm talking about like Squaw Valley and behind that. Well, Northridge would be in the city limits, where they have, I've watched the machines dig mm-hmm. out sections that will be like pools out our way. When we have a Christ Community Church, they have a pool that they keep in reserve for runoff of water. And when it's really flooded, that's where the water goes instead of flooding out their property.
Mm-hmm.
And it's good to see that. I appreciate how, I know it takes time, it takes money for them to do that kind of preventive, but really helps for downstream.
One limiting factor we do have is state of Iowa did put some regulations in effect that inhibited county and city's ability for regulating stormwater. I think that may have some unintended consequences for our water quality. The reason cities and counties were regulating stormwater is trying to address water quality and quantity issues. And now in some cases, our hands are tied and cannot do what we wanted to do. We're learning how to do it differently. That was last year that put in place, was put in place, effective last July.
Just interested, how many slides do you have in this presentation?
A lot. What did Marcus say, 40-some?
It shows you did a lot of work, and it's very professional, very good. You know your stuff. You've showed it to us very well. Thank you.
Well, thank you. It's a combination of several slideshows I've done over the years, and I think one of them is 200 slides, so I've pared it down.
Well, thank you for narrowing it down to 40. It was great.
Done.
Okay. Well, thank you, Leanne. That was very informative, and I know I learned a lot. Moving on to public hearings, we have none. So, hooray there. And then that takes us to comments. Any comments from staff?
You will have a July meeting, and we will be bringing some regulation changes to you.
All right.
And we will have, maybe not yet.
Yeah, we may or may not have a conditional use permit for you.
Yeah.
And I do want the rezoning has been through first consideration a couple weeks ago with the Board of Supervisors. They've not scheduled for second consideration yet because Manats is working with conservation and the city of Ames on the conditions of approval. And once we have a signed conditional rezoning agreement, the second consideration will go back to the Board of Supervisors.
Can you tell us where those considerations are being considered for the rezoning?
What do you mean where? Here.
Are they something where like the city wants some and the Story County has some, and so if the city wants to rezone?
No, this is for the Manats rezoning that you all reviewed and had a 2-2 vote last time.
Okay, got it.
Sorry, I wasn't tracking.
That's okay.
All right. Thank you for that, staff. Any comments from the commission?
Just to clarify, and I know it's in my calendar somewhere, but is our next meeting on July 2nd? Because sometimes that gets moved around because of the fourth weekend order. So is it on the 2nd or the 9th?
I think it's on the 2nd.
Okay, that's great.
It is the 2nd.
Okay, thank you.
All right. In that case, I would take a motion to adjourn the meeting.
So moved.
I second.
All right. All in favor?
All right.
Aye.
All opposed? Great. Meeting adjourned at whatever time it is, 4:45. 4:55. Yeah.